So it's the 6th of December, 2017, and I'm Rick Hansen. And last week, we talked about that really interesting aspect of wise speech, which is optional but desirable, that it be wanted. And then I turned that around and I said, what do we do with speech that is unwanted? How do we look first and foremost at our own conduct, as the Buddha emphasized again and again, look to ourselves first and foremost, and be careful ourselves about speech that's unwanted, particularly including in the larger context quite recently and very appropriately and long overdue, a real attention to unwanted sexualized behavior coming at people on a spectrum from weird and gross all the way up to horrible assault and everything in between. And so it's in that context that I wanted to raise the question of speech that is unwanted, and by speech I'm including behavior, gestures, body language, touch, actions. And I want to be clear as well that I'm not equating what's at the relatively mild end of that spectrum with what's at the very severe end of that spectrum. And so we opened up the topic last week, and it's a topic that I want to make room for, including people's individual reflections on what paying attention to their own speech and behavior that's unwanted. And also tonight I want to especially focus on what if you're on the receiving end of speech, communication, behavior that's unwanted. And I want to look at that topic through the lens of the Buddha's teachings, as well as sort of informed by some recent thought and method in psychology and in human relationships. So that's what I want to offer tonight and then open it up. So very briefly, let's presume that when you're in a situation, when something's coming at you that's unwanted, and it could be fairly mild, it could be really serious, it could be a kind of a one-off, you can't believe it's happening kind of thing, or it could be a recurring pattern. The intentions behind it in the other person might conceivably be positive. They might be trying to help with their infinite wisdom again and again and again. Potentially. And again, in my joking here and my kind of broadening of the topic, in no way, shape, or form am I trying to minimize or somehow soften the edges of of any kind of misbehavior, anything that's problematic. So the point is, even if it's well-intended in the occasions that it might be, or neutral and unwitting, still, when it comes at you, let's presume that's coming at you is unwanted. And that word is a large umbrella term that includes a lot of things. Okay. So first, I want to just offer a series of thoughts, reflections about that, and then open it up. The first thought or reflection is this teaching of the Buddha and the people who kind of followed after him, who emphasized again and again the value of good company and the usefulness of disengaging from, you could say, bad company. There's a strong emphasis again and again about friends who are supportive, disengaging from people who lie, disengaging from people who gossip, disengaging from people who don't communicate in good faith. One of the things that more and more attention is being paid to in our public political, public policy sphere around discourse is the growing presence of communication that's clearly in bad faith. It's not about constructing. It's not about discovering the truth. It's not about any kind of sincere attempt to find common ground. It's just in bad faith. Buddha recommended, as much as one can, getting away from those kind of people. And it's to me, it's quite useful to appreciate the fact that the Buddha was talking about this at a time when people were very rooted in their villages, in their tribes, in their bands, in their clans. It wasn't always that easy to get away from unwanted behavior, and it wasn't always so easy to join with wanted behavior or like-minded people. Today it's much easier, generally speaking, to disengage, to unfriend people, to block that person on your Twitter feed, or simply not pick up the phone when it's screened by voicemail. It's not always possible to do that, but we're more mobile today. We have more options generally, not always, particularly if one is being attacked suddenly. But the point is that in a context in which the people of the Buddhist time didn't have, as a generalization, anything like our mobility and options, generally, with important exceptions, even so, he emphasized really looking for community and disengaging from what just doesn't feel right. Maybe it didn't feel right the first time, and you're not quite sure, but by the fifth time, by the tenth time, enough already. So that's the first thought, just a reflection on sometimes the wisest thing is to recognize what's happening and just attenuate the relationship, disengage from that person, spend less time with them, do the best you can. That's the first thought, very much from his emphasis. Okay. I think sometimes today in our culture, because it's so easy to have lots of relationships that are sort of superficial even, we can underestimate the importance of being with people who are truly supportive and not being with people who aren't. For myself, one of my main metrics inside myself when I think about being with somebody is, how do I feel when I'm with them? Do I feel bigger or smaller? Do I feel better or worse? Do I feel like the best in me is pulled out, or do I feel like I'm always swimming upstream in some strange way? You know, it's like that feeling, so trusting that feeling in yourself. That's the first, I think, offering. The second suggestion is to slow it down and really see what's happening. And often what's useful there is what the Buddha called noble silence, where we don't add fuel to the fire. We don't get contentious and quarrelsome. We observe. There's the story, perhaps true, perhaps mythic, of the Buddha's night of awakening, at one point in which he was assaulted with lots of unwanted communication from Mara, the deity force in the Hindu frame of ignorance and delusion, and therefore evil. And so Mara kept coming at the Buddha, tempting him with riches and beautiful women and tremendous power, frightening him with demonic visions, terrible characters, assaulting him, clearly, with much that was unwanted. And what the Buddha did was not argue with Mara. He didn't yell at him. He didn't read him the riot act. He put his hand on the ground, it is said, and drew support from Mother Nature. And the fundamental statement, I have a right to be here. Or as our daughter puts it really bluntly, you be you, I'll be me. That gesture you see sometimes, drawing support. And it's not combative, and yet it's resolute and grounded, establishing refuge for yourself. And then fundamentally the Buddha said or thought, essentially, I see you, Mara. I see you. The Buddha wasn't criticizing Mara, wasn't counterattacking, was simply recognizing, aha, I see you. I see what's coming at me now. And it really helps to slow it down and try to understand what's happening. Is this merely a clueless person who's being really inappropriate and stupid? Or is this some kind of sustained malevolent attack? There's a difference there. Is this someone who's overreacting on the worst day of their life? Or is this a recurring pattern of behavior? Is this their MO, actually? It's kind of a seeing. Also in the seeing, you're buying yourself time to figure out, wow, should I just let this pitch sail by and never talk to that person again or really disengage? Or is this really worth my getting into it? And then you decide. But if you give yourself that gift of time, you can make a choice that's a lot wiser. And it reminds me as well of the power of dignified silence. Some of the most potent political leaders certainly in recent memory, were able to sustain a dignified silence. I'm thinking of these photographs I've seen of Dr. Martin Luther King, where you can see he's just watching people. And there's calm, and there's love in his face, and utter resolve. And it reminds me of a passage I read from a Native American author, who I'm sad to say I can't remember his name, who was saying that, and you can take this different ways, it's probably not worth taking it to an extreme. He said, looking back, in the larger context of everything that happened to the Native people, the first people in this continent, roughly 90% plus of whom died during the process of Europeans coming to this continent, North and South and Central America, mainly through disease, but certainly through other means. In that larger context, he was writing and he said, the greatest weapon we had was silence. Well, it's just very profound to kind of reflect on that. Maybe we don't want to use a word weapon or something, but greatest resource was our silence. And I think sometimes just watching someone, not reacting, not falling backwards, nor attacking forward, just watching them is very potent, very potent. That's the second thought. The third thought is to clarify for oneself your actual material interests in the situation. What are the stakes here? What are the stakes? Is it a big deal? Is it a small deal? Is it that actually they can't hurt you in any real way, but you're just embarrassed that they're talking with you in that way? I don't mean just embarrassed like that's bad, but I mean there's a distinction. What are your material interests? Is there a safety issue that's real? Are your material interests what's happening to other people? Like, what are the real stakes on the table? And I think it's really important to neither overreact nor underreact. So that's the next one, the clarity around the actual stakes. And I think about times where I didn't like the words they said, but the truth is nothing material in my life was affected by the words they said. I still had my children, I still had my marriage, I still had my job, I still had my life. Nothing really was harmed. And I think sometimes we can get caught up in reacting to things that actually don't have material consequences. On the other hand, sometimes what's happening has very material consequences and we somehow feel unentitled to deal with it. And that's a different kind of pitfall. So clarifying for oneself, what are the actual implications for me personally? What are the stakes? How big a deal is this? And then I have two more suggestions. The next to last one is to draw on the teachings of nonviolent communication. How many of you don't know that form? Okay. Oh, okay, most people know it. It's a very simple structure. It's a complex system developed by Marshall Rosenberg and others, but the essence is very simple. It's a way to talk to other people. The essential formula is, when X happens, or happened, I feel Y because I need Z, essentially. So X happens is when you keep interrupting me, when you come at me with that tone, and I want to describe that tone pretty accurately. It's quite objective, when X happens, not when you're an idiot, right? That doesn't count. When X happens, as if a neutral, fair-minded person was describing it, okay? I feel Y. I feel sad. I feel hurt. I feel totally rattled. I feel shocked. I feel alarmed. I feel both hurt and angry. Not, I feel you are an idiot, right? But what especially experientially, like I feel a nausea or a hollowness in the pit of my stomach. I feel like I can't breathe. You know, just kind of as close as you can get to your actual experience. Okay? And then I feel that because I need something or other, especially human universal needs. Not, I need you to stop being an idiot, but I need to feel respected in important relationships. I need to feel I can trust people that I make agreements with, that their word matters to them. I need to feel physically safe when I'm around other people. I need to know that my children are safe from your children. This is what I need. Do you see the formula? Then often there's a movement into a request. So from now on, I request such and such. That's not inherent in nonviolent communication, but it's a natural follow-on. And that's where we might make a vulnerable request to a person, or a real request. Not, I request you stop being an idiot. More specific, concrete. I request that from now on, we take kind of turns, and I get about as much airtime as you do when we talk. Or I request from now on that you don't call me after 9 o'clock at night. Or I request from now on that you don't wave your hand in my face like that. And then they do what they do. But that's the approach of nonviolent communication. And then you go back and forth about that. It's not a perfect system. I think a lot of the times we work stuff out with people more informally. It's messier, it's okay, if it's going well. But if it's not going well, I've used this system myself more than once. It's really quite helpful. It helps you be in a kind of strong and dignified place, and it lowers the odds of the other person getting agitated and inflamed, because it kind of filters out a lot of unwanted speech from us that would be inflammatory to the other person. Okay. And then the last kind of situation I want to name is one in which it's not really appropriate to get touchy-feely in terms of nonviolent communication or something like that. Maybe you've done that and you're past that point with the other person. Or maybe something's coming at you that has an immediacy to it. And I find there what's really helpful is to have thought about it in advance as much as possible, because in the moment we're often swept away. Sometimes things come at us and they're a one-off event. They're just really weird. I remember walking down a hallway when I was probably a senior in high school, very busy hallway. There were 2,700 kids in my high school. And as I walked by, somebody punched me hard in the stomach. Just boom, like that. I was shocked, turned around. 5 seconds probably had gone by, and I could not identify my attacker. They got me. You know, it was a one-off. What could I do in that moment? But and it was fairly mild compared to a lot of one-offs that happen in the lives of people. But often there's a recurring pattern. We've seen this person do it to others, maybe someone we work with, maybe someone we work for, maybe we've seen them do it to us, maybe we've been warned, maybe over time we're observing a pattern in our family, maybe it's how our teenager talks to us. And so then there's an opportunity to sort of prepare and to think it through, what you really want to say. And I have two suggestions about that, and then we'll open it up, see what you think. The first suggestion is to recognize the difference between communicating for yourself and communicating to change the other person. I think there's a place for trying to influence the other person, including making it clear what consequences will be if they keep doing what they're doing. And the other person might say, "Don't, you're threatening me." And I would myself think to myself, so what? But beyond that, I'm just naming consequences, right? Like, there's a police officer sitting at a traffic light. I don't feel threatened that I know I'm going to get a ticket if I run through the red light, but they're letting me know, you know, hey, you run that red light, there will be a consequence. So the first thought I have is to be clear about the difference, because when we're trying to plead with others or wheedle with them or lecture them or try to shame them, then we're very invested in what happens inside the black box of their mind. And we don't have much power there. And people get very preoccupied with trying to make certain things happen in the minds of other people. And I think myself of what I call the 80-20 rule, that sure, put 20% of our effort on trying to get something good going in the mind of the other person or try to get something problematic to cease and desist, but 80% speak for ourselves, communicate for ourselves. And that's a kind of speaking in which we're confronting others, in which we're primarily about going on record for ourselves, knowing that we've spoken our truth for ourselves, sometimes knowing that other people have heard us say that, minimally knowing that they know that we know that they heard what we had to say. And there's a kind of self-respect and a peacefulness that comes with that. That's a very important style or mode of communicating. It's useful to recognize it in your own body. And then the last thing I'll say about it is to be prepared to go to the moral level. I think that's very interesting. Now, in nonviolent communication, there's a deliberate effort to steer away from righteousness and fault-finding and moralizing, and I get that point. But I think there's a real category in life where we're just beyond when X happens, I feel Y, because I need Z. And we move from the level of how I feel about it to the level of that is wrong. That is immoral, that is criminal, that is abusive, that is awful, or whatever it is, because some things are those things. And I've known a lot of people, often very well-intended, good-hearted people who don't want to hurt others, who get trapped at the feeling level and lack the moral confidence to call it for what it is. That's a lie. That's cheating. That's clearly communicating in bad faith. That's totally inappropriate to do in this something or other, to call it, to be willing to claim for oneself the moral authority when it's appropriate, being careful about it, to call it. And there's clearly the example of the Buddha who was willing to call it. He was willing to call it when monks probably nuns as well, certainly we know more about this with monks, who just broke the rules. He called it very directly. Or when people would come to him with these kind of crazy ideas and would try to argue with him about it, at some point, there are these classic lines, I just love it, "Oh, foolish man." I just think the Buddha's voice in my head, "Oh, foolish man." I just think that's an important thing. That's a very serious step to take, but a willingness to do that, to name it, to call it, and to have a moral confidence in oneself about doing that. Okay. So that's the offering here. What would you like to say? What are situations you've been in? What's worked for you? If you hear what I've tried to talk about tonight and you think about applying it in a certain situation and it doesn't, and it looks like there's something more that is needed or doesn't seem like it might work, you know, what? Please bring that up. And anything else you want to talk about. Great.
Hi. So I really appreciated the topic last week.
Yeah.
I thought it was quite timely for people because it was after Thanksgiving and perhaps we had communicated with family that we don't always, and that's certainly what happened with me. Mm. And I felt much better after, the question that I'm sitting with, I'm still sitting with. So I had an incident where I overheard my stepmom talking to a good friend of hers who's also a mentor of mine with a lot of inaccurate, negative communication about me. And I was really hurt and really shocked. And I sat with it and I meditated, and because my father's health is really quite precarious, I decided not to say anything as a gift, sort of like my stepmom doesn't need one more difficult, heavy issue to deal with. And I don't know that I'll keep that, but I'm sitting with the part of me that wants to sort of feel like be bigger and say, you know, she needed she just mm-hmm. has the way she thinks about me. Like, there were so many negative things, boom, 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 that it was so clear that she just has this negative perception of me. And how much do I want to get in there and stand for myself and try and shift that? And I don't want to cause her any sense of shame, you know, for having really spoken badly. Like, she is really stressed right now, and yeah. she needed to blow off steam, and I would, you know, run under the bus, you know, inappropriately. And maybe I just let it be like that for the duration of our relationship.
So if I could ask you, what do you consider your material interests in this situation? What are your priorities here? What is really consequential for you?
Well, for me, it has to do with just when I visit and the sort of block she has in allowing me to provide support for her and my father. Mm. And as long as she continues to see me in this really negative way and minimize or reduce or not be able or willing to see the contribution I am making, then she wants to limit my time staying there.
Yeah, so you're there you're in reference to your care for your father, right?
Yeah,
that's a very real. So that's clarifying, isn't it? So you think about if that's your material interest, that's the stakes on the table, then in light of that, what seems to make sense to you in terms of communicating or not with your stepmother?
I still think it's important to be really sensitive to her stress level.
Yeah.
And she's super overwhelmed. And it may never make a difference whether I correct her and say, you know.
But why does her stress level matter? I'm not saying it doesn't, but again, material interest.
I care about her.
Okay, that matters.
And
yeah.
She's watching her husband potentially die right in
yeah.
front of her. And that's super hard. And she gets like a pass in a way.
So it's, I have a friend who's a medical ethicist at Harvard, and so it's really interesting to talk through these issues because they're kind of ethical. So even in this situation, you have three interests being balanced. Your interests or needs to be respected, et cetera. Your father's interests and needs to have your daughterly care for him come through, including through this other channel, his wife, and your stepmother's interests in not being too stressed and so forth. So then the question is, how do you balance those material interests? See what I, but this is how to think about it, in my view. You know, and again, it's very clarifying.
I mean,
not like Spock would. I mean, at the end of the day, it's about your gut, what your gut tells
there's
you.
There's one possibility that when I visit next time that yeah. I, you know, could check out if there, I mean, this was really intense, you know, so
yeah.
intense. We really are not, his health is so precarious. And
yeah.
if it improves and yeah. I visit again and she's a little less stressed, I can test out, hey, there's something I'd like to talk to you about. I don't really want to be,
yeah.
you know, stress you out, but it's here for me. And then, you know, test the waters and see how her response is.
Okay. Oh, yeah, I don't have a right answer about it, but I find that this way of looking at it is very helpful. What really matters, what's important, and why? And then balancing that. And sometimes you're right. You conclude that you don't really care what they think as long as they never say that again, right? Or as long as they send the check. You don't care what they think. You know what I mean? It's like,
I mean,
so.
The kind of harsh reality is that as long as my father survives, I care because it impacts my relationship with my father.
Yeah, that's right.
So
yeah.
That's where it's at.
Well, that's very good. Thanks for being willing to go back and forth with Smidge.
Yeah.
All right, great. Tom.
Yeah, I had a question about when you're in a dialogue with someone and there's a disagreement about what the facts of a situation and the other person is clearly wrong.
I know that feeling, Tom.
And I'm reporting accurately.
Mm-hmm.
I said 10 minutes ago.
Yep.
And so what do you do in that situation?
Well, first let's say it's true, and I think sometimes it is true, right? Again, I would just ask, what are your stakes on the table there? Like, is it, what's in your material interest there? And I can say sometimes I just get caught up in correcting people.
Yeah.
And the truth is, that's not what I would consider my material interest. On the other hand, if that's one thing. The second thing is often people argue about the past. It's a structure of so many quarrels. I'm a longtime couples counselor, family counselor too, and I've been married a long time. And so people argue about the past. And again, well, do we have, what's our material interest? What's our substantive interest? Like, what matters about them thinking in their head that the past is a certain way? See what I mean? And sometimes we actually don't have much, if any, real stake in that. But other times we do, because we want them to understand how affected we were by what happened, and they need to get what actually happened. Or sometimes, frankly, we're serving notice with people that, well, I'm not going to really get into a big argument with you about the past, but I'm going to send this shot across your bow, and you're going to kind of get, maybe in a personal relationship or even a business relationship, that I'm actually paying attention. And I'm not, again, you've got to watch the ego here, but I'm not someone to mess with in this way. To just, I'm going to use a really technical term. There's this famous paper called On Bullshit. And I'm just not someone you should bullshit anymore. Like, let's get real. Like, sometimes we do that, and so maybe that's a material interest. We want to communicate that to somebody. Or more generally, we want to get at, how does this happen? That plain as day, this occurred. We start staring at people. Early dementia, you know, or something, or again, I'm not trying to trivialize that, but we're trying to understand that, and sometimes we just really need to talk it through. So I would just say those things, but I would also add, at least for myself, to watch that tendency to just want to correct other people.
Thank you.
But at the end of the day, for the Buddha, it was like, what's actually true? And then going forward, for me, it's always really helpful to focus on from now on. What from now on?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I have just a quick
please, question. Yeah.
What I found feels really useful for me, and I've been very surprised at the weird array of reactions it gets in other people. I use the sentence, we'll just have to agree to disagree about it.
Sure, yeah. Right. Do you think it's because they are reacting to your clear statement that you just see it differently than they do?
Yeah, my sense is that, no, you have to agree with me.
Yeah. All right. I think one place where it gets tricky is when what you're talking about is what was happening in their mind. It's when we attribute intentions to other people or states of mind that it gets very tricky to agree to disagree. You know, and so I just want to raise that. Sometimes we're talking about the fact of the words that were said or how often the behavior occurred or when the person finally did come to the meeting or etc., right? It's pretty factual. But often we're kind of arguing about what was happening inside each other's minds. What were your true intentions? What were you really feeling? What are you trying to do here in the relationship? And then it gets very tricky to try to fight over what are the facts. And for me, at that point, I try to recognize that and pull out of that argument as fast as I can, because I'm not on very solid ground there. Because they're the expert. They're the world's expert on their own mind, right? Just like we are too. And then, as much as possible, focus on from now on. I find that very, instead of arguing about the past, make agreements for the future as much as we can. Yeah, great.
I just want to bring up something dicey, and that is, you know, the unwanted attention, you know, within the family.
Okay. So that's unwanted speech, it's unwanted attention. Like
unwanted speech, you know, inappropriate jokes. Yeah, I'm talking about my father, right?
Okay.
And, you know, remarks even about my mother. And, you know, and at the time, you know, being young, and I don't know how old, you know, being frozen.
Yeah.
Being frozen and not being able to say stop. Well, later on, I remember there were situations where I really said stop. There was never any kind of sexual abuse, but I realized, you know, that these things, you know, just these remarks, it was so important because I just put up this barrier and I started hating him, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I started hating him. And it took a long time until that actually could melt away, you know. So what I'm bringing up is I have no idea how young people, how they're dealing with this kind of thing. If all dads these days are much more aware and conscious. So, but I think this is something that is probably still going on, you know.
Oh. Yeah. Do you have any reflections on that or suggestions you might offer to others in that situation from your own learning?
Well, I wasn't able to come up with any kind of a retort, you know, an answer in the situation itself. I was just like sitting with a lot of uncomfortable feelings and with anger. And
if you had felt, and this is for everyone really in these situations, if you could have slowed it down, let's say, and felt internally free to choose the wisest response, including wise. Based on caring for yourself and taking care of your own needs. If you could have done that,
what would I have said?
Yeah, or not said or done, or what approach might you have taken? And I want to emphasize an inner freedom and non-reactivity. We're not swept along in their movie. We're holding our ground for our own truth and unilaterally exercising agency wisely, which might mean remaining silent, but it's based on an inner freedom and autonomy, not from being frozen or bullied. Right? Tracking those differences? That's the crux. So,
well, I would have said,
what? Yeah.
I would have said, you know, but that would have been very evolved, right?
Yeah, that's right. No praise, no blame, but sure. Yes, really hard, that's it.
Care of your own sexual dissatisfaction and frustration and don't put it on me.
Okay, how's it feel to say that?
It feels very empowering.
Yeah, and I'm not trying to do therapy with you or anything, but I could just feel that from you, yeah.
Because that's what it was.
I see you, Mara,
yeah.
I'm naming the truth. And I'm unafraid. I may be anxious around.
I don't want to have anything to do.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm going to stick my neck out here, and it's part of an interest I have in some of these sort of taboo topics in Western Buddhism, like aggression or disgust. Disgust. Like you could see that in your face and the feeling. It was disgust. And that's part of the moral thing. And I think there's a place for healthy disgust. where we call it. Like, that's repelling. That's terrible. I'm disgusted by that. I've done certain things in my own life when I had definitely a sense of disgust with myself. Like, what? Right? So there's a place for it. And I just want to kind of call that out, that sometimes it empowers us and strengthens us to be willing to access a healthy disgust. I think of it as a yellow flag. Arguably, the very first emotion that evolved was disgust, where you spit out. Think of animals, worms, like they spit it out. That's very primal. Disgust and fear, both forms of aversion. So it's very potent. You got to be careful with it. And yet, to me, it's very empowering to go there. Yeah, go on.
I felt actually that I was the adult and he was the misbehaving youth, teenager or whatever.
Misbehaving, and you were willing to call it. Yeah. I just realized I've gone long here.
That's okay.
So I'm not disgusted with myself about that. I reserve that for bigger game. We got to really... On 30 seconds?
Let me just say one quick thing. You mentioned Marshall Rosenberg in passing.
Yeah.
And his work with nonviolent communication. And I think the last couple of people that I've taught, if you could Google him and get a slice of his work, or he's got a whole series of DVDs on nonviolent communication. And a very valuable resource, I think.
Oh, yeah, I think definitely true. Well, thank you, everybody. And a lot in this topic, huh? I want to say a word about, so next year I'm going to do probably a series of talks related to what I call neurodharma, and in a kind of a sequential way really go through some fundamental ways of looking at the Buddhist teaching through the lens of modern evolutionary neuropsychology in really practical ways. So just I want you to know that, and I'm thinking about how to do that, including potentially videotaping some of what I'm doing in a way that respects your privacy. It would just be about the talks portion. But I'm also very interested in what you'd like to explore. What are the things you hope we get into next year? So just know that, and maybe we'll talk a bit about that next week. Okay? Wanted and unwanted speech. That way we sit for a minute.
I really like that that we are more participating the last two times or so, because I kept coming here and, you know, it was like a gray mess for me, you know.
Of people, yeah.
Of people, yes. Yeah. And so it, and I'm not so interested in being up there and chit-chatting, you know. So I really appreciate the way that you know people are coming out with something real. So thanks for doing that.
Oh, definitely. Mm-hmm. It's a balance, but yeah. But thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, how about we sit for a minute and we'll finish. Well, take care.
That's right.
Thank you all.